last week's flight of the SpaceX Falcon 1. Is it fair to call it a success? And what's next? I'm Paul Plack, and this is Aero News. Space Exploration Technologies hopes to prove that commercial development can lower costs and increase reliability for spaceflight. The company also hopes to transport cargo and crews to the International Space Station, and ultimately to play a role in getting to Mars and beyond. On March 20th, we all watched as the company's Falcon 1 rocket enjoyed a successful launch and stage separation, but shortly afterward had a telemetry loss and ultimately was found not to have reached its intended orbit. We're here to talk about the significance of the demo flight and what's ahead for the company. My guest is Gwynne Shotwell, Vice President of Business Development for Space Exploration Technologies, more commonly known as SpaceX. Gwynne, thanks for taking time to talk with our Aero News listeners today.
Absolutely, I'm happy to.
I want to talk first of all about you and your job a little bit, because the background to me is fascinating. We don't talk to too many women who have a resume that looks like yours. What early influences led you to an interest in satellites and space exploration?
You know, it's pretty interesting, actually. My mother is an artist, and I was always good in math and science. And she actually pushed me. I was actually supposed to go to cheerleader camp. I was a football cheerleader in high school.
Uh-huh.
And she pulled me from camp and said, no, you need to go to this Society of Women Engineers seminar down on the south side of Chicago.
To which the other jocks in school said, huh?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I was horrified, right? I mean, my interpretation or understanding of an engineer at that time was someone that was very nerdy, you know, had very little social skills, and certainly was not something that I was thinking about or forecasting for my future. But my mom took me down to this seminar at Illinois Institute of Technology, a Society of Women Engineers seminar, and I didn't connect with any of the female engineers that were up on this panel until the mechanical engineer rolled in 10 minutes late with this beautiful suit. And I said, okay, I could do mechanical engineering. You know, this was really, this woman was right on, and she had a beautiful suit, and I thought, okay, I could be an engineer. So it was a very flaky beginning, I have to admit.
Well, Gwynne, fortunately, your mom was an artist and an open thinker, and it occurred to her to push you in the direction of your talents and abilities, because I know you're a little bit younger than I am, but still, at the time you were coming through this, this was not a career path which was a typical choice for women.
That is correct. And it still isn't, actually. I think when I was in when I was getting my undergrad in mechanical engineering, there were three women in my class out of 36, so under 10%.
Okay. Well,
my guess is it might be as high as 16 or 20% now, but it still is not a typical career path for women.
Let me ask you a little bit about your resume. Before you got to SpaceX, you were with a company called Microcosm Space Mission Engineering.
That's correct.
The two companies look like they have a fairly similar mission profile, and that is to develop low-cost launch vehicles that have rapid deployment capability. How are the companies different?
They're substantially different, actually. I did not work. Microcosm had two major divisions, engineering divisions at that time, the launch division, the Scorpius division, and then my division, which was the space systems division. So I didn't work the launch side there. But Microcosm, it's an interesting little company headed by Dr. Jim Wirtz, who's another industry visionary. Microcosm relies almost solely on government contracts. It's funded that way. So the money that it gets is very hard earned from that perspective, but is also subject to the whims or the cyclical congressional cycles in financing. We've had the benefit at SpaceX to have Elon Musk, my boss and the CEO here, who is the primary investor. He had available funding at hand, and so could apply it in the time frame that we needed it, as opposed to the time frame when the fiscal year came around. So SpaceX, on that element alone, will always be able to move much quicker in the development process than a government-funded company.
If I remember correctly, SpaceX has about 160 employees.
More than that now.
Okay, well, even if it's a couple of hundred, how many employees would NASA need to do this same kind of job?
Well,
they'd have more employees than that just to move the paper.
There's no question that if you are in a commercial development environment, you can be far more efficient. The risks that we take are not risks that our stakeholders need to address with the taxpayers or Congress.
Mm-hmm.
The risks that we take are purely business-related risks. And so you know, the business leader, in this case Elon Musk, gets to make that decision. And so it doesn't have to go through a series of briefings or channels or letters. You have an issue, you go right to the boss, and you lay it out, and a decision gets made immediately, not 6 months from now.
Well, Gwen, tell us about the day that phone call came where it was Elon Musk, we want you to come to work for SpaceX. I assume there was a phone call like that.
Yes, actually. There was another business developer in the job prior to my taking this job. It was kind of a part-time off-site position, and I met Elon. Actually, I came over to SpaceX to pick up a friend to go out to lunch, and I met him, and I said, I think he needed a full-time BD person, and left, and then got a call, I don't know, a couple of weeks later saying, you know, we'd like to interview you for this position. I said, well, you know, I'm going to be traveling tomorrow, and his assistant, Mary Beth, said, well, how about 5 minutes? So I got in my car and drove over and did an interview.
We'll be back with more stories from the files of things that would never happen in government in a moment. Seriously, though, that, you know, you talk about an entrepreneurial private sector company being able to move very quickly. That also applies to what you just talked about, the process of getting the right people on board.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Even on the flip side, if there's someone here that's not doing the job that needs to get done at SpaceX, you don't have to document it for 6 months or 9 months before you can get rid of them, or, God forsake, 2 years.
Yeah.
If something's not working out, it's not good for either party. It's not good for SpaceX, and it's not good for the employee. And so we can, you know, clean shop, and it's not a negative thing. It's actually very positive. What I think is negative is for people to sit in jobs that they're not executing on, collect a paycheck, and probably internally is pretty miserable, knowing they're not doing a good job.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so, yeah, it's a very refreshing environment, I have to tell you.
Well, let's talk about this small staff. Now, most of the executives in SpaceX have at least some engineering background. The company's description on the website describes it as an engineering-driven company. You're a VP of business development with an engineering background. Is the company still small enough that you get a chance to be involved in the technical side from time to time? And do you look for that?
I do, actually. I'm more of a systems engineer at this point than a detailed technical person.
You like to think in block diagrams, basically.
Or, you know, systems engineering to me is as much people engineering. You know, where are the errors going to occur? It's going to occur between groups, right? Linking groups where communication isn't necessarily as tight as it needs to be, mm-hmm. or there's an interface and, you know, everybody's busy doing their own things and have they focused on the interfaces. So I am able. We have a senior staff meeting every Monday. And it does go on quite, it's a lengthy meeting, but I get to hear all the technical VPs report basically progress and issues. And I think I have some insight that I can lend based on my almost 20 years in this business.
Well, you're in a position now where you're looking for customers down the road for SpaceX. So far, the company has done a lot of work for the government through DARPA, and it's looking at a possible big Air Force contract. When does the industrial commercial side of your job kick into high gear?
Actually, the manifest is pretty interesting. We've got about a third government customers, about a third commercial, and about a third international. So they're there. They're just a little bit quiet at this point. The early customers that we have for both vehicles are both government. So that's why the focus, that's why you hear it, basically. It's just because the early customers, for instance, DARPA and the Air Force were the customers for the first two Falcon 1s. Actually, the original first customer was TaxSat 1 from the Office of the Secretary of Defense.
Right.
So, the first three customers for SpaceX on Falcon 1 are government. The fourth customer is the Malaysian Space Agency to launch the RazikSat spacecraft. That's actually a very exciting mission.
Gwen, I have a follow-up on that same line of thought that I want to hold till after we take our break in a moment. But first, I want to ask you about something Elon Musk said a couple of years ago. He said that he's driven by the desire to see humans become a multi-planet species. Is this overall vision shared company-wide?
I think that vision is shared pretty, certainly more broadly at SpaceX than in the population at large. The people here are working on, I mean, you have to have mavericks, at least for the early employees. You have to be kind of a maverick in the industry to risk, you know, quote unquote, a safe job at a large company,
mm-hmm.
and come over to a company like SpaceX where the vision is awesome. It's just that the folks that have tried to do this before haven't been successful. So, you know, there was high risk from that perspective. And I think mavericks in general are explorers. as well. And I think anyone that's into space exploration wants to work at SpaceX and probably does.
The term safe job with a big company may be a historical term. We'll have to explain that to some of our listeners later.
It's sure. Yeah, and you know what? My guess is more people on a percentage basis get laid off from big companies than not. But you're right. You're absolutely right.
Well, we need to take a break. But when we return, let's talk about the objectives for last week's launch, including the ones that remain to be reached, if that's all right.
Absolutely.
My guest is Gwynne Shotwell, Vice President of Business Development for Space Exploration Technologies, or SpaceX. We'll be back with more in a moment. This AeroCast is brought to you by Aircraft Engine Services, makers of the aluminum V220 and V300T engines.
How up-to-date is your aircraft engine? Automotive engineering has advanced so much over the past 30 years that you almost never have to raise the hood. Why can't an airplane engine be just as simple and just as reliable? Now it can. Check out the new V220 and V300T from Aircraft Engine Services. The all-aluminum construction of the V220 and V300T gives these engines the best power-to-weight ratio in their class. Earlier aluminum block engines suffered from excessive wear unless they were protected with heavy steel cylinder liners. In the V220 and V300T, each cylinder bore is surface-coated with Nicosil, an electro-deposited nickel coating containing hard silicone carbide particles. The benefits of a better power-to-weight ratio include increased range and higher useful loads, with less of a trade-off between fuel capacity and passenger or cargo carrying capacity. The AES V220 and V300T, as simple as a car's engine, but oh so much more fun to drive. Check us out on the web at VAircraftEngine.com or call us at 321-268-3718. Aircraft Engine Services, the shape of things to come.
At Cirrus Design, we don't ignore the fundamentals of aviation design. We just give them an ingenious new interpretation. The Cirrus SR22 GTS, Cirrus's premium luxury ride that has come to define Cirrus aircraft as one of the world's elite. Every dream option from supple leather seats to an exhilarating 310 horsepower performance and speed come standard, giving new meaning to the phrase fully loaded. When flying the SR22 GTS, getting there is truly more than half the fun. To learn more, call 888-750-9927 or check us out on the web at cirrusdesign.com.
Finally, aviation headsets have evolved. Clarity Aloft is the next generation of headset design. Clarity Aloft headsets employ patented Comply Canal tips composed of soft viscoelastic foam, the same foam tips used in advanced hearing aids. More than simple earplugs, these foam tips provide full-spectrum noise reduction and outstanding attenuation. This advanced technology is lab-tested, proving that viscoelastic passive noise reduction is superior to active noise reduction. For more information, call 612-747-3197 or check out the innovative Clarity Aloft headset on the web at clarityaloft.com.
Welcome back to this Aero News special feature. I'm Paul Plack, and my guest today is Gwynne Shotwell, Vice President for Business Development of Space Exploration Technologies, better known as SpaceX. Gwynne, again, thanks for taking a few minutes out for us today.
Absolutely. I'm thrilled to.
Want to ask you about a couple of things on the website and just ask you to comment on them, if that's all right.
Sure.
In an era when most technology-based products follow a path of ever-increasing capability and reliability while simultaneously reducing costs, launch vehicles today are little changed from those of 40 years ago, unquote. Given that that SpaceX sees this as the future, what are the opportunities specifically to improve capability, reliability, and cost?
Okay. You know, I actually have a three-hour pitch that I gave to Congress on why is SpaceX low cost? Why are our products low cost? There certainly is no silver bullet answer. I believe the real reason comes from the fact that the entire focus of the company has been focused on design a vehicle that's operable, that you can operate highly reliably and at very low cost. So everything that we do focuses on those two things. Elon is a hound about cost. You know, when you come to him with your design solution or your operation solution or even my business processes and solutions, the answer, well, this is just the way you do it in this industry, never works, and you're going to get in a lot of trouble if you use that excuse. You need to explain why that's the right answer from a cost and reliability perspective. We think about buildings, as a matter of fact. If you do horizontal processing, your building is cheaper because high bay space is incredibly expensive, factor of 5 or factor of 10 more expensive than kind of regular warehouse assembly and test space. our launch operations, all horizontal processing. You don't need a mobile service tower, which one of the funniest things I've ever heard Elon say is a mobile service tower is a high-rise office building on wheels on a federal range. There's nothing cheap about that.
That's right.
He's absolutely right. You know, the Russians don't use them. They do their stuff horizontally because I believe they're forced into a low-cost environment. SpaceX has taken those philosophies to heart, and it's throughout every bit, from the technical design of the vehicle itself to the ground support equipment to the operations to the facilities.
You know, one of the things that I've been amazed at the last couple of years is the degree to which NASA has become involved in the XPRIZE Cup. Realizing that maybe taking a couple million dollars and putting it into a prize purse gets more bang for the buck than going out and hiring the staff and trying to build that process in-house.
Absolutely. Prizes are a great way to facilitate commercial business. You basically bring in venture capitalists and other investors who are savvy investors, and I think the weak get separated from the heroes from that perspective. You also get a multiplication on investment. Burt Rutan and Paul Allen and the Spaceship One team received $10 million for the XPRIZE. I think they spent $20 or $25 million
Correct.
On their project. And then figure out what everybody else spent. So the XPRIZE spent $10 million, but the total investment from everybody else was probably $100 million or more. So it's a great way to leverage investment, as well as get people enthusiastic about the industry. You know, you involve the population or new entrants, new developers in a program, and you're going to get a lot more excitement, I think, than the standard approach.
In all fairness, after Spaceship One successfully won that prize, Richard Branson came along with his checkbook open. So it all worked out.
That's correct. Yeah, I think they're probably smiling.
Well, another statement on the website, quote, "The Falcon 9 and Falcon 9 Heavy are the only U.S. launch vehicles with true engine-out reliability." What exactly do you mean by that?
The primary causes of failures in launch vehicles, we've done a pretty thorough investigation, is clearly the propulsion element. It's basically you've got a fire, an explosion that you're trying to control to push hardware through the atmosphere. If you have a failure of your engine or an anomaly on your engine and your single string on your engine, then your mission is over. With 9 engines on a Falcon 9 or 27 actually on a Falcon 9 Heavy, an engine can go out, actually 2 engines per core can go out per flight, and the vehicle still has the capability to get to orbit. You're not single string.
Is this a new development in rocketry? I haven't paid a lot of attention over the years to how other rockets are done.
The Russians do it, although not the same. They have, I think Soyuz has 28 thrust chambers on their vehicle. They definitely have redundancy. U.S. just generally does not. It's all single string.
Okay. Well, did last week's Falcon 1 demo give you the confidence you need to move to the operational phase? I know things get real expensive and real black and white at this point.
Absolutely. We were very pleased. We've been criticized for stating publicly that we were pleased with our progress last week. If you look at where we've come from the flight a year before, though we did get good data from that first flight a year ago, we've made incredible progress. We ended up testing or demonstrating every element, every command sequence in order to get to orbit. Now, the fact that we had that roll on the guidance, navigation, and control system prevented us from getting to orbit, but we even initiated the payload separation sequence. So we got through the entire process. We gathered as much telemetry as we possibly could, and we're still analyzing the data, of course. But so far, the anomalies that we saw in that flight look very fixable. And yeah, we're enthusiastic to get back to the flight line.
All right, let's talk real briefly about what those anomalies were. In essence, when the stages separated, there was a bumping that started a rocking that was aggravated by sloshing of the remaining fuel in the second stage. How do you solve that?
Well, you can solve the sloshing issue with slosh baffles. It's pretty... I mean, it's relatively common. I'm not sure why we didn't put slosh baffles on the second stage at the beginning. I think we felt that maybe there wasn't as much propellant. I don't know. I'm actually not a propulsion engineer or a fluids engineer. So you fix the slosh issue with slosh baffles. There's some ways to prevent the contact that occurred during the separation sequence as well. So I think we can eliminate both those effects, as well as hopefully, get a little bit more margin in on the control system.
I know you're going to be picking up people, enthusiasts who are following the project on your website, who haven't been there since the beginning and maybe haven't caught some of the early answers to early questions. So let me ask you about this one. Why is the ability to do a quick turnaround after an aborted launch strategically important?
It's critically important from a corporate perspective because a launch day at any range is a very expensive day. It's about $100,000, if not a little bit more. So if you basically exercise the range, you say, okay, today's your launch day, and you don't execute that day, you got to do the same thing the next day, and you're $100,000 in the hole. So from a corporate business perspective, you want to get that vehicle off on the day that you say you're going to. Also on the corporate, on the business side, customers care about launch dates and launch time frame reliability. I heard it loud and clear at the Satellite 2007 conference that the most important thing to the GEOSATs, the COMSATs, is to launch when they say they're going to launch. So having a quick recycle time, I think, is critically important to moving towards that as well. Now, if you want to talk about national security, in order to reconstitute space assets that may have some sort of attack on them, you want to get them up as quickly as you can. So a quick turnaround launch is extremely important as well.
For example, if some terrorist organization figured out a way to take out GPS, you'd want to get it back online.
That's correct. And you know, the Chinese just had an ASAT demonstration a month or so ago. They took out one of their own.
Mm-hmm.
But Chinese basically have the capability to destroy an asset in space. So I think it's something we all need to be a little bit concerned about.
We talked a little bit about, you know, the payloads become much more valuable now as you move into the operational phase. If an expensive satellite goes into the ocean, it's going to be hard to smile and say, but we gathered good data.
Oh, that's an irrelevant statement for operational missions. You either get to orbit and you put the satellite where it needs to go, or you don't. It's very binary in that case.
Well, now, as a customer looking for a launch vehicle, they look at SpaceX. How do they justify the decision to go with you guys? Is Lloyd's of London involved? I mean, obviously, if they're doing this with a company that has not yet successfully inserted a satellite into orbit, there are significant risks involved that may outweigh the cost savings. How is that all managed?
We actually planned our manifest around getting launches that don't need to be insurable early in the manifest. For instance, the first two launches for Falcon 1 were demonstration launches. The first operational launch is for TaxSat 1, which is a government launch. And granted, you don't insure a government launch. There's no question that we don't want to put that one in the ocean. We want to get that to the orbit that it wants to go to. But it doesn't necessarily hurt the insurance market. Now, the first insurable launch for SpaceX is the Malaysian launch later this year for the RazXat spacecraft. So we will have to have demonstrated success in order to make sure we have reasonable insurance rates before that mission.
Gwen, how frequent will these launches become? How routine and how regular? Will this be the kind of thing where I can plan with my family to come by the atoll within a certain time window and be fairly much sure of seeing a launch? Will it ever get that regular?
When SpaceX is operational and executing to the production planning that we have, that we'd like, then my guess is there'll be a SpaceX launch at least every month.
Well, here's one final statement and a final question to go with it. With the Falcon 1, Falcon 9, and Falcon 9 heavy launch vehicles, SpaceX is able to offer a full spectrum of light, medium, and heavy lift launch capabilities to our customers, unquote. Does that mean you already have a manifest started for the 9 heavy?
No, we've got a couple of proposals out, though.
Okay.
No manifest for the Falcon 9 heavy, but we do have 6 Falcon 1 launches on the manifest and 6 Falcon 9.
Gwen, it will be fun to watch your company. Congratulations, because you have your own really interesting career arc going, and we'll want to keep in touch with you as well.
Absolutely. I've enjoyed it.
My guest has been Gwen Shotwell, who is the Vice President for Business Development for Space Exploration Technologies, also known as SpaceX. And you've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. On the web, you'll find us at aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.